Labour supporters drowned their sorrows, while Green Party campaigners were bouncing off the walls at our European election results party. But what exactly should we make of these results for the future of Britain and Europe? And what's the fallout for Britain's torturous Brexit process? These are the questions we'll be asking on today's podcast with me, Luke Cooper from Anglia Ruskin University. Regular listeners will notice a slightly different format for today's podcast, which was primarily recorded at the Another Europe election result night. I spoke to Laura Parker, the National Secretary of Momentum and a sadly defeated European parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party. She was pretty candid and pretty angry.
The Fidesz Party under Orbán has just got 52%. Le Pen's party have won in France. What the hell are we doing? Not pulling out every single stop to beat Farage, and we didn't. Every one of our 500,000 members should have been called to action, and they weren't.
I also caught up with Amelia Womack from the Green Party, who was in, suffice to say, a slightly different space after their historic election results saw them make four gains, bringing their cohort of UK MEPs up to seven. We'll be hearing from them and more a little later. But first up, let's start with the wider European picture. If you were watching the BBC coverage of the results as they came in, you would be forgiven for thinking this was a national election, not a European one. So we won't make that mistake here. In the run-up, many had focused, and perhaps with good reason, on the rise of the far right all across Europe. But it was a mixed night for Europe's nationalists, and they won't have enough support to play the role of power brokers in the new parliament. In France, Marine Le Pen's National Rally, formerly known as the National Front, topped the elections, but actually lost two seats compared to their 2014 result. In Denmark, the Danish People's Party, who had won the 2014 election, took a battering, winning just one seat and 10% of the vote. But in Sweden, the extreme far-right Swedish Democrats improved on their vote in both the 2014 European elections and their 2018 general election results too, winning just over 15% of the vote and three seats. The picture was different elsewhere though. In the Netherlands, the Freedom Party lost all four of their seats, while a new far-right startup, the Democracy Forum, only won two. Manfred Weber, the centre-right European People's Party leader, was also quick to rule out seeking a deal with the far-right in order to win the presidency of the European Commission.
I want to clarify that for the EPP, for the European People's Party, there is no chance for any cooperation, no will, no readiness for any cooperation with extremists from the left and from the right.
But look a little closer and this doesn't fully stand up to scrutiny. Weber himself has been a big opponent of a welcoming immigration policy in Germany and elsewhere, and one of Europe's most extreme parties, Viktor Orbán's Fidesz in Hungary, remains part of the European centre-right that Weber heads up. Albeit, Orbán's party is currently suspended from membership pending an investigation, but that didn't stop Weber himself campaigning alongside Orbán in these elections. You would be forgiven for thinking that his opposition to far-right extremism is therefore somewhat hypocritical. For its part, Orbán's Fidesz party romped to victory with 52% of the vote. In Italy too, Matteo Salvini's hardline anti-immigrant party, the League, won 34% of the vote. A smaller fascist party, Brothers of Italy, also scooped up 6% of the vote, bringing the total far-right vote in Italy to some 40% of all Italian voters in this election. In Poland, the far-right Law and Justice Party confirmed its growing grip on power, winning 26 seats and 45% of the vote. Elsewhere, however, momentum was building around progressive visions of Europe. There was a green surge, with the party increasing its seats in the parliament to 70. In the European constitutional and political process, each party grouping nominate a Spitzenkandidat. This is a German word that just means lead candidate. The idea is that these candidates compete for the role of Commission President. It gives MEPs and the Parliament a lot of power to determine the political composition of the European Commission. But not only does this mean the Parliament has to agree a candidate, they also then need to get agreement from the Member States too. Many countries are unhappy with the Spitzenkandidat process. questioning whether member states should have to accept a nomination for the president that comes from the European Parliament. All in all, it means a lot of negotiation and hard bargaining lie ahead. Scar Keller, one of the two lead candidates from the European Greens, said they would use this position as a bargaining tool for their policies in the European Parliament.
We want climate protection. We want a social Europe. We want that civil liberties and democracy rule throughout the European Union.
So the European Greens had a good night. But for the European Socialists, it was a much more mixed one. In Spain and Portugal, they won convincing victories. Pedro Sanchez telling a press conference, "We are going to build a social Europe, a Europe that protects," as his party's gains offset the losses of the Party of European Socialists in Germany. In Portugal, the Socialists of António Costa also romped home, but there was also an impressive result for the radical party Bloco, who scored higher than the traditional Communist Party. So what does all this mean for the future of Europe? As expected, the centre-left and centre-right have lost their majorities, ending the period of bipartisan consensus in European politics for the first time in the 40-year history of European elections. But with both groups pivoting to their respective lefts and right anyway, there was perhaps always less scope for cooperation between them. This means that the Liberals and Greens could play a decisive role in the nomination for the new European Commission president. The Liberal centre, encompassing the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe and Macron's En Marche party, as well as a new Romanian outfit, are set to rule out backing Weber for president. In a statement previewed on politico.eu, they argue the election calls for a commission president that can build a, quote, robust majority way beyond the partisan lines. In other words, not Manfred Weber. Sanchez and Macron are now due to meet one another. Could this lead to a socialist commission president or a liberal? Frans Timmermans, the candidate of the European Socialists, will be hoping for the former. But the biggest result of the elections? Arguably the turnout. With 51% of European voters heading to the polls, it was the most popular election in two decades, underlining how European issues have a new salience in European domestic politics. Perhaps we have just seen the first genuinely European EU election. For more on the EU elections, I'll point to you in the direction of a report I've drafted with two colleagues at the London School of Economics, The Dawn of a Europe of Many Visions. You can find it pinned to my Twitter profile, go to twitter.com/LukeCooper100, or at the LSE Conflict and Civil Society website, or at the European Alternatives website. So now to Britain, where Nigel Farage's Brexit Party won the election.
Ladies and gentlemen, dare to dream that the dawn is breaking on an independent, united kingdom.
Ominous indeed. I spoke to Laura Parker from Momentum shortly after the disappointing news on the results.
I was really proud of the campaign that we ran. We were a little scratch team of volunteers. I mean, literally, you know, a woman that I met on the phone bank 3 years ago campaigning for Corbyn, a guy from my CLP. I went down to Woolwich one day canvassing, and this young woman arrived and said, "Oh, I like making videos, can I help?" Elena, obviously, who you know, who's been giving me a hand. But all these people kind of doing things in their lunch break, you know, or in the morning before work or in the evening after work. And I suppose the positive for me is, look how much we managed to do with really no resource, but a lot of determination. So I think there's a lesson there for the party in terms of rethinking how it campaigns. I mean, a much more distributed model in which people have, and this is probably the bit that we didn't have, but, you know, a clear message, a clear sense of purpose, and then you let them get on with it. So that's been really, really great. A very empowering campaign for our little band, I would say. Another big positive for me has been the number of people who I wouldn't have said or necessarily consider themselves to be on the left, might not have felt comfortable until relatively recently describing themselves as socialist, who have been really, you know, energized and joined in. I mean, you know, our arguments, actually, if they're given the space, will win. And the manifesto which we were standing on, particularly the manifesto of the Socialist Party from Brussels, was really, really positive. I mean, very ambitious, unambiguous. This is about tackling inequality, fighting climate change, workers' rights, migrants' rights. I mean, the other thing that's been really heartening for me, and there's a big lesson for the party here, is the number of people who've just nodded along when I've talked about freedom of movement. I mean, we've all been encouraged to think that this is the bogeyman, can't be mentioned. I mean, I've been on campaigning platforms with Seb Dance, so I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning. I mean, he and I do not come from the same political stable. We've often laughed and joked about it, actually, as we've been around London together about how we're the odd couple. He's completely and utterly relaxed about the language of defending freedom of movement. I mean, he means it. And I think there are lots of lessons there for the party in terms of having more courage about, you know, a straightforward, unambiguous socialist agenda for Europe. I mean, that's what people want. People across the Labour Party want it. So that's been really great. I mean, there's a lot on the lessons learned side about what's not happened. I think it's no surprise to anyone if I say the party was caught off guard. I don't think it's just that they hadn't expected these elections to happen. I think a part of the party leadership didn't want them to happen. Part of the party leadership reasoned that we would have left the EU by now. Another part actually actively wanted us to have left the EU by now. And this really stymied advanced planning. So, you know, we came late to it. The leaflets were late. I met people who said that they had already sent their postal vote in before they got a Labour leaflet. So there were some basic things in terms of the operations where clearly, you know, we were caught off guard. Now, of course, it's easier for the Brexit Party to be prepared because they don't have any parliamentary representation. They didn't fight the local elections. You know, Farage has been building up to this, well, for the past 20 years, actually. But still, you know, we're a big machine and we've got to learn to turn the steam tanker around a little bit more quickly, I think. The party's not as fleet of foot as it should be. But the more significant learning, really, has got to be about the basic politics. And I think Eloise Todd summed this up really well. Eloise, who is best for Britain, but was also campaigning. And I'm really sorry, I mean, really gutted that she's not been elected this evening. It's an enormous loss to the European Parliament. She would have been an exceptionally good MEP. But, you know, Eloise said, uniting the country does mean determining a destination. Now, I'd kind of slightly mistakenly called it picking a side. And my thinking's evolved in the last 3 weeks. I mean, it sort of is about picking a side, but it's more about saying we've got people on two different sides, but we can only go in one direction. Now, it's abundantly clear the direction that we need to go in is to reject Brexit. You know, the party has tried with different degrees of enthusiasm, good faith, I believe, from our negotiating team. I mean, I think both Keir Starmer and Becky Long-Bailey, very serious people, very well briefed. I'm absolutely certain they approached those negotiations in good faith, but the truth is that we cannot help the Tories deliver their crackpot Brexit. And actually, most of us started from the position that there is no so-called sensible Brexit. We now know this to be true, and we also know that the country doesn't want it. Because although people are going to say that Farage has won this election, I mean, he hasn't. You know, he's got his 30%, but that means 70% of Britain does not want the Brexit Party. So the biggest single lesson is the most obvious one, which is that we have now got to take a good, hard look at ourselves. I think we should be canvassing opinion of the party members and coming out, in my view, unequivocally for a public vote has been the only way of resolving the mess that we're in. And Parliament is paralysed. There's no reason to think it will be anything other than that after a week's holiday. And in fact, now we've got the spectre of a Boris Johnson premiership. We should be even more worried about a no deal. So I think we're going to have to come out unequivocally for a public vote. And my view is that we should be the party of Remain and Transform. No ifs, no buts, no more equivocation, because it's not paid off for us this evening.
Your description of the party being left napping was quite generous in a way. I mean, the party didn't want to fight these elections and didn't put anything organisationally into winning them. So I agree that Nigel Farage is a minority in Britain, but he's an even smaller minority in Europe. And isn't there a lesson here about how we think about internationalism?
Yeah, look, I do agree with, I mean, generous, diplomatic, still a candidate. You know, I mean, in the end, you stand for a party. I think it would be churlish. I don't want to sound like the grumpy candidate who didn't get elected. Although, to be honest, I knew I wouldn't. The moment that I found myself fourth on the list, I think I knew it would be very difficult. But yes, there is a lesson here, because I think where we've been really negligent, I mean, almost cavalier, I would say, is we've kind of said, oh, this is about stopping the far right and Farage, and we don't want Farage sitting in the hemicycle with Marine Le Pen and her mates Orban and all the rest of it. And then we didn't mobilise. And we have really let down. I mean, I'm here with my much-quoted Italian husband, who's been my calling card for the last 4 weeks. Every time I've met someone who's questioned my European credentials, I've kind of wheeled out my lovely Italian husband. But, you know, he came over this morning from Italy, where they are now facing the prospect of a strengthened Lega. And the five-star movement looks like it's collapsing in on itself. But this is no comfort to anybody. I mean, Salvini, he's a right winger. I mean, you know, there's no ifs, there's no buts, there's no equivocation. The Fidesz party under Orban has just got 52%. Le Pen's party have won in France. What the hell are we doing? Not pulling out every single stop to beat Farage, and we didn't. We can dress it up how we like. Yes, it's been complicated. It is true we have tried to unite the country, and it's true that that's complicated, and it's true that in the world of, you know, the Today programme and the soundbite politics, it's been very difficult to articulate a nuanced position. But in the end, one thing was clear and one thing was simple. We had to beat Nigel Farage. Every one of our 500,000 members should have been called to action, and they weren't. And that actually, you know, fail to canvass in haste and repent at your leisure. But it's not just us that will be repenting. No one is going to thank us around Europe for this. I mean, of course, there will be sympathy and all the rest of it. Our sister parties will be sorry that we've not done better. But I don't think we're going to be easily forgiven by some of our European partners. Because we do, you know, for reasons that we on the left don't like, but, you know, imperial weight and colonial history and all the rest of it, the truth is that we are disproportionately powerful and we should be using that power to a progressive purpose, and we didn't. And I mean, and we've got to take a good, long, hard look at ourselves and ask why. I mean, where were we? Where were we? It's no good saying we're now mobilizing for the Peterborough by-election. That's cold comfort to my Italian husband who's just come over from Italy, where Salvini's lot are now winning. And it's absolutely no comfort to your friends in Austria or the Hungarians or the French. The only place it looks like maybe they've gone into reverse a bit is Germany, which obviously, you know, great. Thank goodness for small mercies. But we are an internationalist party and we let the side down, I think, really.
On the night of the election results, Emily Thornberry told BBC News that the party should now unambiguously back a Remain position.
Emily Thornberry, just to be completely clear, you're a very senior member of Jeremy Corbyn's team as Shadow Foreign Secretary. You're saying right here, even at this early point of the night, you will be trying to persuade your party to change its policy, to have a referendum, whatever happens, and to campaign to stay in.
Yes, that's my view. And I think that in the end, I think that, you know, we have done everything that we can to try to get a decent policy on leaving the European Union, but I think that things have now moved on.
I asked Laura if she agreed with Thornberry.
Well, I haven't seen Emily Thornberry, but on the description that you've just given, yes, I do. That is my personal view, and that is my, you know, we still need to win the argument, obviously, but I don't think we have any choice. I mean, it is who we are, and it's what we were 3 years ago.
Laura's final thoughts celebrated the defeat of Tommy Robinson and offered her congratulations to the Green Party.
I would say two really positive things about this election, aside from the kind of intra-Labour Party learnings and all the rest of it. It's absolutely brilliant that Tommy Robinson's been trounced. I mean, that's really, you know, that was just unequivocally great news. And personally, I'm pleased to see the Green Party doing well. Despite the fact this is a proportional representation system, it is one that's weighted in favour of large votes, and it's quite difficult for the Greens to cut through. I think, you know, we've recognised a climate crisis. I think they have a massively positive contribution to make. Obviously, I would have liked the Labour Party to do better, but I've, you know, I'd much rather people, if they can't go red, they've definitely got to go green and not yellow or any other shade. So I think those are two positives.
At the beginning of the night, before the results came in, I also spoke to Alina Ivanova from the Another Europe staff team, who had been volunteering on Laura's election campaign.
it was basically me taking my annual leave, helping Laura out. So that was fun. It was a great way to spend some holiday. I mean, it was very much mixed picture. The Labour vote, which we all know is very strong in London, I would say was split very obviously between people who, you know, are lifelong Labour voters who, as soon as they see the sticker, they may not know an election is happening, but they greet you on the doorstep and say, oh yeah, I always vote Labour. You know, the estates in Vauxhall, the estates in Bethnal Green, the estates in Enfield, you get that kind of a response. And then on the other hand, you had people who are deeply worried about the Brexit process, obviously, deeply involved in various Remain campaigns or otherwise, just keep up with the news constantly, who would keep you for 20 minutes on the doorstep berating us as, you know, Labour volunteers about the party's mixed messaging. And it has been very difficult because where people look for one word answer to their questions, anyone representing Labour had to launch into several sentences, basically explaining what we were trying to do.
Laura and Alina were not the only disappointed activists on results night. Sabrina Huck is a Labour Party campaigner in London. I asked her how these elections compared to 2017.
We had some places where we had a quite strong Labour promise last time. They probably voted for Labour last time because they thought that Labour's position on Brexit was kind of more pro-EU than it can transpire to be along the, you know, the road after conference and all of that. So people wanted to this time vote for an unambiguously Remain party. But again, I have to say that there were particularly ethnic minority working class estates where the vote really held up for Labour because they saw the threat of the Brexit party as a specifically racist party. So they would stuck with Labour to avoid the Brexit party to gain a lot of seats.
Simon Hanna is a radical historian. He said Labour Party policy tried to bridge an impossible contradiction.
I think the Labour Party abandoned the election organisationally, really. I don't think they were particularly interested in it. I think they didn't really want it to happen. I mean, the day after the Brexit referendum, Jeremy Corbyn called for the immediate calling of Article 50. So I think you can tell from the leadership of the Labour Party that they wanted to get out of the European Union as soon as possible. So I think they also feel, alongside the Tories, that this election really should never have happened and they want to be out of the EU by now. Politically, I think they suffered because they're trying to ride two horses. A lot of Labour members and Labour voters are Remain. There's a minority who are pro-Brexit, both members and voters, and they are trying to appease both wings, and that's an impossible contradiction.
Michael Chesham is another Europe's national organiser.
Result I last watched come through was Scotland, which is incidentally where I'm from, with Labour losing two MEPs. And a result in Scotland in which the Conservatives returned an MEP and Labour didn't. And that is just an absolute extraordinary result. You know, this is a place where we used to, where Scottish Labour activists used to, well, and Scots in general, used to boast that we had more pandas in our zoo than we did Tory MPs in the country. And there you have with Labour on nothing and the Tories on one.
Michael didn't mince his words on what was at stake now.
These are terrible election results for Labour, but specifically for the Labour left. These are election results which essentially a tiny number of mostly unelected officials within the centre of the top of the party, the people immediately around Jeremy Corbyn, many of whom are ideologically in favour of Brexit. They think it's a good thing, they want it to happen, and they're willing to make sacrifices to make it happen, chose to lose these elections. They chose to sacrifice Labour's electoral success because they thought that was a price worth paying for preventing a shift to a pro-referendum position. And their gamble is that voters to the left, to their left, on Remain and on free movement, will have nowhere else to go when it comes to a general election, that those voters will all come back. I don't think they will all come back, frankly. I think there are people in this election who are so angry. You talk to people who are out campaigning on the doorstep for Labour. They're talking to voters who are as angry as they have been over any issue since the Iraq war, and who may well semi-permanently defect to a smaller anti-Brexit party. I think that's a disaster, and it's a disaster for the left.
For her part, Green Party Deputy Leader Amelia Womack was certainly happy to welcome these new voters. I asked her about the implications of the Brexit Party victory were for the left.
I think how you combat the rise of the right wing and populism and racism is a question that is a serious question of our time, but something that we need to take lessons from our history as well. And I think we do need to unite about this, and we need to be making sure that we're working cross-party. I don't think there are always clear solutions, but we are stronger when we work together than when we work within our individual parties. It requires leadership. It requires leadership from everybody, making sure that we stand against hate in our communities and making sure that we are tackling the racism in our press and media. The fact that some of our papers are able to print complete racist fallacies time and time again needs to be addressed. We need media reform, and then on top of that, we need electoral reform as well. And that's quite a bureaucratic answer, but if you look at what happened with the EU referendum, then it really was to divide a battle, sorry, to overcome a battle within the Conservative Party, because within that party there is more than one party. I look at the Labour Party and I can see at least two parties in there, and that's how you get people like Jeremy Corbyn sat in the same place as, well, people like Chuka, but obviously they've decided that it's just not the party for them anymore. But if we had people who would be elected under different Labour groups that sat under a Labour umbrella, like we have in the European Parliament, and the same with the Conservative Party, it would mean that we wouldn't be having the internal battles of political parties playing out within our own politics, that the divides that we see in those parties don't then divide the whole country. And I think there's a real conversation that we need to be having about how our political system that is based around division is now playing out in our communities as well.
Looking at these BBC results, I mean, it's incredible. You would think that there isn't a European election happening. It's all completely focused on Britain. But it's actually been a really good election for the Greens in Europe tonight as well.
Absolutely. We're seeing the Greens surge across the whole of Europe, not just in the European elections, but in other elections as well. And I think it's showing the fact that there is a change in what people hope to get from their politics and their politicians. I really hope that this will mean that the issues like climate change will remain on the agenda. We've taken clear leadership on issues like refugees, saying that we need to have an ocean rescue in the Mediterranean rather than having criminalising people that will save people's lives when they're fleeing war, and taking a clear point on austerity, not just here in the UK but across the whole European Union, saying that it's unacceptable and that we need to be working internationally. And with things like, while we've been talking about Brexit here in the UK, across the world, the UN has released two reports, one saying that we've got just 11 years to tackle the worst effects of climate change. That doesn't mean putting policy in place in 11 years' time. That means putting policy in place in the next 11 months so that we'll have actions within 11 years. And I think these European, as well as the report that said, as a result of human activity, we'll lose around a million species. And I think people have seen that we need action, not at the next election within our own countries, but we need international action, and the European Union is the best place to take that.
That's all we've got time for today. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can find a full back catalogue of podcasts on www.anothereurope.org, where you can also join the campaign. You can send us ideas for podcasts on Twitter on @another_Europe or email podcast@anothereurope.org. We'll be back very soon. See you then.